activation commands into the lectern, which brought Battery 12 online, were aptly named. Most of them were mid-sized ships, like the skirmish corvettes that sometimes accompanied the larger warships like Bright Lance or Reaper's Lantern. The enemy vessels made Gunnar think of giant sea urchins, even if they were more oblong than perfectly circular. They were bristling with ordnance and seemed to have evolved to perform only the one task. They would fire their biospines through the void like giant railgun projectiles. Then the spines, or the pieces of them that penetrated the outer armor, would explode in a tempest of deadly splinters. "Zeke, let's get eyes on," said Gunnar to the lead spotter, a man who ran the four-person targeting team positioned near his command lectern at the top of the downward-sloping gun deck. "The Jarl said within the hour, so instruments will already ping them, but I want visual as soon as possible. Should be any minute now." Zeke nodded and fastened a full-faced helmet over his head, a device that would give him a continuous feed from both the Bifrost's central system, but also the individual feeds from each of the guns in Battery 12. There were four of them, the larger equivalents of the notorious infantry chain-fire support weapons, wicked-looking anti-air quad cannons that fired tremendous bolts. Each one was run by a five-man crew, one trigger man, one target master, one tech, and two loaders. Gunnar had done his best to spread the veterans out among the four crews. Though only he and Mateo had fought a full Garm battle force, plenty of the others, like Zeke, had shed their fair share of Garm blood in skirmishes over the years. While the Einherjar were disposable warriors when it came to individual battles, each Marine was functionally immortal, and it was only the Blackout or Grendel's poison that took them off the board. For men like Gunnar and his crew, there was only the one death, the one chance to make a difference, and in this war, for those who had but the one life to give to the cause, that meant that the faces of one's comrades changed often. Gunnar watched as his crews loaded giant carbon magazines into the hoppers of each of the quad cannon's multiple barrels. The mechanics freshened the greased gears that allowed the machines to swivel on their gyroscopic mounts, and then double-checked the void seals that encapsulated the 180-degree field of fire. Battery 12 was on the lower section of the Bifrost's second ring, putting them in a position to defend much of the circular Star Fortress's first and third rings. The crew chief lowered the temperature controls in the chamber by several degrees, pushing it down until he could see his own breath mist in front of his face. When the fighting started, the heat from the cannons would turn this place into a furnace anyway. Might as well reduce their energy draw from the central system. Gunnar had no doubts that every spark of power would be needed elsewhere, and he rubbed his hands together to keep them warm as he and the others waited for the enemy to appear. Jarl Edwin was right to have pulled second shift and replaced them with a fresh crew. They did not have to wait long. Proximity warnings blared over the speakers embedded into the walls, and several visual feeds appeared on Gunnar's command lectern. "Hostile ships incoming, visual confirmation pending," announced Zeke, his target finder pinging on several signals, even as Gunnar's lectern showed him the same thing from the central system feed. "We're between them and the sun, so they have an eclipse advantage." "They've attacked us enough to have learned how to use orbital timing in their favor. We'll get exhaust signatures any second now. As soon as that happens, the Watchman will hit them with the big guns," said Gunnar reassuringly, though he wasn't so much saying it to the crew as he was himself. He still wasn't fully comfortable with his command position, especially since he'd risen to the post after only his first battle. While he had accorded himself well in the skirmishes since then, he'd never commanded during a heavy engagement. "Copy. They're firing," responded Zeke, and Gunnar felt a shudder in the deck as a vastly larger weapon system lashed out at the encroaching battle force. Gunnar couldn't tell from the readouts just how large the force was, though he could see that it was smaller, he thought, than the one he'd faced all those years ago. "Fewer ships might not mean a lesser threat," warned his inner voice, the same voice that had led him successfully through a life of violence and squalor before giving himself over to the Allfather. He listened to that voice, always had, and something wasn't adding up. "Alpha and Charlie Cannons, watch your spinward quadrant in case there are breakaways from the main group," ordered Gunnar suddenly. And then, "Bravo and Delta Cannons, eyes forward." "What's that voice telling you, Chief?" asked Mateo over the headset, speaking over the command channel that only the crew chief and each team lead could hear. Last time they came right to us. A straight-up brawl. Guns on guns until one side or the other loses, said Gunnar, working it out in his mind even as he spoke, doing his best to follow the data feeding into his command lectern. That informed him the larger weapons had begun to swap fire with the oncoming force. And that looks like what they're doing, but it feels wrong. After all this time, why do the same thing again? They're the Garm, doing the same thing over and over is how they fight. They wear us down until they can push through, answered Mateo. It's how they win, how they've always won, single-minded and relentless. No offense, Chief, but don't you think the Watchman is asking that same question? Posed Zeke, his voice holding some reservation at disagreeing with his commander, but Gunnar admitted that it had to be said. The Garm adapt. What insight could a Shunt have that wouldn't have already been considered by the Watchman and Einherjar Command? Scald Wallace had been in command of the Bifrost when Gunnar had fought the Great Garm Force. And even without being the Watchman, the Scald had done a fine job of thwarting the enemy's assault. Still, that feeling was there, piercing the back of his skull like a needle. He used to get that feeling, hear that voice of warning during his years as a gangster. When a deal was about to go bad, when a friend was going to stab you in the back, and when he didn't listen to that voice, well, that's why he was a widower and couldn't bear to look at his own daughter. The one time he didn't listen was all it took for his world to be torn apart by the bullets of a rival. And out there in the darkness, he wasn't about to make that mistake again. Still, what could 20 men in Battery 12 do to change the course of a massive void battle? Yet, he couldn't shake it. Something was out there, and it was coming straight for him. Retract guns! We're about to get hit! Shouted Gunnar, finally giving in to his instincts and launching himself into action, going through the emergency blast shield protocols. They wouldn't be able to shoot through the thick plates that began to close over the swiftly retracting guns, but that was a fair trade for protection. It was a credit to the crew that they followed his orders so quickly and with such discipline. In seconds, the guns were retracted and the shields inched closer to full seal. It was a common tactic in the middle of a firefight to pull the guns back and weather a fusillade of incoming fire, then to open them up again and return fire. Yet battle, at least for the anti-air weapons, was far from being joined, or so it seemed. Gunnar sucked in his breath as the orbit of the Bifrost around the small star from which it drew its power positioned the fortress in such a way that a glint of light flared against a shape emerging from the darkness of Garm space. The crew chief just barely made out the matte black hull of a Prax gunship, one of the deadly vessels used by the Scald operatives in the name of the Allfather on multitudes of treacherous missions. No sooner had Gunnar caught a glimpse of the ship than it launched a punishing wave of rockets at the Star Fortress, the stealth tech of the ship having allowed it to approach undetected during the furious exchange of fire between the Bifrost and the oncoming Garm fleet. The blast shield sealed shut just before the first of the rockets pounded into the second ring of the Star Fortress. Battery 12 survived, thanks to Gunnar's quick thinking, though as the deck chief looked to his lectern, he saw that many of the others had not fared so well. Batteries 10 and 11 were redlined, and the garbled transmission from Jarl Edwin in Battery 13 indicated heavy casualties and only one of their four weapon systems still operational. The talk of the fortress was that Scald Thatcher had betrayed the Allfather and humanity and sided with the Garm. Gunnar had never known fully what to believe, as there was so much hearsay and rumor within the ranks of the support staff. The Einherjar were relatively tight-lipped in general, and even the narrative strategy was something spoken of in hushed tones as if none dared to believe it was real. That ship, however, was very real, and Gunnar knew that worse was to come. "Open the shields and go hot!" shouted Gunnar. "We've got incoming!" As the blast shield swiftly retracted, the deck shook with more impacts, though Gunnar had no clue whether they were from Prax rockets or Garm ordnance. His lectern was awash in damage alerts and proximity warnings, and through the chaos of his readouts, the deck chief could see that Bifrost was in trouble. He did not need Zeke to tell him that much of the Bifrost's spinward side had been ravaged by enemy fire. Suddenly, Alpha and Charlie cannons opened up, and the deck pulsed as the recoil dampeners absorbed the tremendous force of the weapons. Gunnar watched as two Garm vessels streaked across the viewport, one of them trailing great torrents of blood and viscera from several wounds torn into their broadsides by the cannons. In seconds, there was an ice trail of frozen gore sparkling in the light of space, and the wounded ship continued to soar into the distance as if some part of whatever course, intellect, or navigational capacity the individual ship had was damaged. The other vessel, however, banked hard and sped directly towards the Bifrost, right into the muzzles of Battery 12.
"Bravo, Charlie, Delta cannons, line up on that ship,"
ordered Gunnar as he recognized the enemy vessel for what it was. "Alpha, stay on spinward, more will come." All three weapon systems roared with mechanized fury as the triggermen spat hundreds of plasma bolts at the oncoming vessel. Gunnar hoped it would be enough firepower to stop the beast before it made impact. The Garm vessel reminded him of an aquatic creature he'd learned about in school as a child, a manta ray or marco ray, something like that. It had an oblong body that flattened somewhat as it tapered off into wings on either side, like a warped dinner plate, though it had a long, tail-like structure, which Gunnar presumed allowed it to stabilize itself once in an atmosphere. He'd fought these things before and knew them to be small-scale transports, capable of flight in hard vacuum and in atmosphere planetside. They were maneuverable and had enough armor plating on their bow that they could weather a significant amount of enemy fire as they approached. It had been a good call to have some of his guns on spinward, as facing down two of them would have been impossible. The armor of the oncoming vessel appeared to hold for a moment, and Gunnar's knuckles turned white as he stared at the approaching vessel, silently willing it to die. Just before the craft approached the threat line, a point in space where the lead spotter, Zeke, had swiftly determined was the minimum safe distance for avoiding a collision and uploaded to Gunnar's lectern, the beast's armor gave in to the tremendous punishment. Chitin cracked across the vessel's bow, and the ship's trajectory shifted as the momentum of the ship was overwhelmed by the force of sustained projectile impacts. The ship's axis tipped into the vertical, exposing the topside of the vessel to cannons hungry for a good target.
"Charlie, strafe that spine," snapped Gunnar as soon as he saw the vessel begin to tilt, and the triggerman adjusted his fire an instant later.
While Bravo and Delta cannons continued to pulverize the ship's bow, Charlie Cannon stitched a line of bolts right up the middle of the vessel. Gunnar watched with satisfaction as he saw several bolts punch through the segmented ridges on the ship's back, causing the vessel to shudder with what Gunnar and his men recognized as a death spasm. The Garm vessels were lifeforms, just as much as any Ripper Drone or Ultra Garm, and Gunnar imagined that this must have been what it felt like to be one of the Hitia elites, who often went safari hunting in the wilds outside the walls of the polluted megacity. Gunnar let out a breath he didn't realize he'd been holding as the dying ship drifted away from their field of fire. Had the Nightmare been able to cross the threat line, then it would have smashed into Battery 12. The armored hull of the beast had a significant chance of breaking through, and even if the vessel perished in doing so, it would have been able to vomit forth its cargo. Bifrost had been boarded a few times in its history, though every time the incursions had been swiftly suppressed by the armsmen. Gunnar had a feeling that the success of the armsmen had been more about how few border swarms were able to make it to the deck than it had been about the potency of the defender's response.
"Strikers on the approach," announced Zeke, and Gunnar smiled, despite the continued din of the damage alerts and proximity warnings cascading across the screen on his lectern.
"Cannons at the ready," ordered Gunnar as he watched his gun crews swiftly vent heat and replace exhausted carbon magazines in anticipation. "Alpha, stay where you are. I don't want any more transports swinging around. Damage reports indicate that most anti-air batteries spinward have been disabled or destroyed."
"Screening maneuvers coming from topside," announced Jarl Edwin over the command channel,
his voice haggard, and the sound of his remaining weapon system firing making it difficult to fully make out his words.
"Strikers are soaking up fire for another transport ship. Be ready."
No sooner had the Jarl signed off when a swarm of the Garm Void skirmishers streaked over the viewport. They were hideous creatures that looked more like flying crab claws that had been severed from the crabs they belonged to. Unlike the transport vessels, the Strikers would never have been able to muster the propulsion required to operate in atmosphere, though the Hive Mind had little need of them, considering the potency of Shrieker swarms in conflict's dirt side.
The strikers were able to utilize the lack of atmosphere in space to their advantage and were covered in what Gunnar could only describe as orifices, each one capable of excreting a gas that would propel the craft in any direction, giving it a 360-degree range of movement that most other ships, even exclusively void-borne ones, did not enjoy. Of course, Gunnar thought to himself, as his three ready cannons began taking shots at the claw-like vessels, they weren't really craft at all. The strikers had no cargo, only payload, and once they'd fired all of their caustic projectiles, the ships would return from the direction whence they'd come. Often, after a star battle, there would be hundreds of them floating in space just out of weapons range, having flown and fought themselves to death. The larger Hive ships would gather them up, presumably to recycle their corpses and grow a new swarm. Already his crew had splattered four of the creatures across the void while Alpha Cannon pounded bolts into the transport they'd been screening. Gunnar knew the ship would be back, as it was better prepared for Alpha's attack and had angled its armor toward the cannons. The deck chief was confident that his crew could handle the strikers for now, and so he took a moment to dive into the damage reports on his lectern. While Battery 12 was active and doing its job, the former ganger wanted to see how the rest of the fortress was faring in the aftermath of the Prax assault. It only took him about 30 seconds to realize that Bifrost was doomed. Whether it was the gunship or the Garm, the entire spinward side of Bifrost, the part facing the sun, had been ravaged by the enemy. Gunnar risked several more precious seconds as the tiny voice in his head insisted that he look deeper. The deck chief pulled up the timestamps on when different batteries went down, and soon a picture of deadly betrayal began to reveal itself. The first victims had been the anti-air batteries, most of which fell moments after Battery 12 was attacked. From what he could see, Gunnar estimated that the Prax gunship had made at least two strafing runs, firing its full payload of rockets and cluster bombs to destroy or radically reduce Bifrost's capacity to defend itself from smaller attack ships and transport craft. While the big guns continued to exchange blows with the massive Garm ship-to-ship weapons, according to the buzzing mess that was the full-spectrum display of scannable ships in the immediate vicinity, the Garm were taking advantage of the gunship's actions even now. Gunnar opened up his comms to the ship channel to confirm, and indeed his ears were filled with radio traffic from multiple deck chiefs and fortress command elements. Spine frigates were moving against the fortress in swarms, many sacrificing themselves to the big guns so others could pass over the threat line unopposed by the now silent anti-air close-quarters batteries. As the frigate swapped death for death with the massive fortress weapons, the striker swarms flushed out the few close-quarters batteries that were still online, forcing the weapon crews to deal with the claw-like ships while giving the transport vessels a window of approach. The Garm are inside! At first, Gunnar thought it was his inner voice screaming at him, and then he blinked, realizing that it was the voice of Jarl Edwin booming in his ear. The Jarl had opened his command channel, and Gunnar, along with the other Battery 12 leads, listened as the sound of shotguns and alien screams filled the line just before it went dead. Matteo did not stray from his weapon and kept shooting. Zeke stood up and turned to face Gunnar, his face draining of color as the sickening reality of events began to overwhelm his mind. Gunnar looked up from his lectern in time to see Bravo Cannon pulp a striker as it flew through the weapon's cone of fire. He turned his head and saw Alpha Cannon drive off a transport ship that was already somewhat wounded as the cannon and vessel continued their deadly dance. Delta Cannon went down before Gunnar could shake off the shock of what he'd just seen on his lectern, taking a series of direct hits from three strikers that swooped in for a shooting run. Charlie and Bravo slaughtered all three ships as they banked after the run, but the damage was done. Caustic projectiles smashed through the armor of the weapon's cage, exploding as their outer shells were stripped away to cover the gun and the crew in a sort of acidic slime. The last thing Gunnar saw before the automatic vacuum seals slammed shut were the bodies of the men turning to red sludge that mixed with the slag running off of the melting gun. "Borders, sir!" cried Zeke, his voice shrill with near uncontrollable panic, and Gunnar was thankful that most of the other men were so focused on their task that they had not noticed. "We have to clear the deck!" "If there are targets in the air, we stay on station," Gunnar growled over the command channel as he locked eyes with Zeke, who returned to his chair after a moment's pause. The voice in Gunnar's mind was insistent that the battle was lost, and though the deck chief agreed, he wasn't about to abandon his post. Bifrost was the greatest military achievement in the history of humanity, a rugged son-of-a-bitch star fortress that had survived countless attacks. It took a betrayal from within to give the Garm the foothold they had now, and even that wasn't a guarantee of defeat. If men in positions like him stood their ground, kept doing their job, then there might still be a chance they could hold out. Besides, it wasn't like the Watchman was going to call for an evacuation. They would win, or they would die, and that was the only mentality that would defeat the Garm. Battery 12 continued waging its small part of the war, but as the bulk of the Garm warships grew closer, more and more swarms of transports and strikers filled the void. Gunnar heard the muffled sounds of shotgun blasts from the other side of the hatch, though he dared not mention it to his crew. In the last 5 minutes, they'd lost Charlie Cannon and its gun crew, their corroded bodies now sealed off along with Delta. The deck chief walked briskly over to the weapons locker on the far wall right of his lectern. Though mutiny was not something that the armies of the Allfather had ever contended with, it was still policy that only the deck chiefs and armsmen had access to firearms aboard the Star Fortress. Even the Einherjar left their devastating pulse rifles in their ships when they were aboard. Gunnar fished out the necklace bearing his key to the locker and inserted it. Inside the locker were two auto shotguns, identical to the ones carried by the armsmen, one for the deck chief and one for his most trusted man, or at least that was the official protocol. He supposed that meant Mateo, though presently the trigger man was still focused on maintaining a steady rate of fire in the target-rich environment that had become of the void surrounding Battery 12. The fact that they were still up and fighting had attracted a significant amount of enemy attention. As if in answer to his musings, a swarm of the Garm flyers managed to screen the combined fire of Bravo and Alpha cannons with the bodies of half their number, only to unleash caustic fury with the remaining half. Bravo Cannon and its crew were reduced to slag in an instant, though Mateo and Blaine were able to leap off of the mount for Alpha and squeeze through the gap before that melting weapon was sealed off. Gunnar realized it had only been a few minutes since this engagement began, and it already felt like a lifetime. He was down to 6 men, including himself. "Nothing we can do now about the fight in space," said Gunnar as his men gathered around the lectern, their duty stations now either melted or useless. "But the wolves are inside the gate." Gunnar himself had never fought in a boarding action, though he'd been given the brief training course on the use of shotguns aboard ship, as had every man on the crew. The deck chief handed Mateo the other shotgun, and the trigger man made a show of checking the cylindrical magazine before racking the slide to chamber around. Each weapon could fire as fast as a man could squeeze the trigger with a 30-round cylinder. It was generally the case that in the swift and brutal fighting of a boarding action, there was little chance to reload. While armsmen usually carried 2 backup magazines with 10 rounds each, Gunnar and Mateo were going to have to make do with what they had. "I'll take the bow. Mateo, take aft. The rest of you, between us," ordered Gunnar as he prepared to open the hatch. "If the ring falls, they'll shut the causeway to the inner ring. We have to get there before the boarders do, or we'll be stuck here with them." The assembled men nodded, each facing a jumble of emotions as they considered close-quarters combat with the Garm. None of them, including Gunnar and Mateo, had ever seen one of the alien monsters up close. They knew of the Ripper drones, Shriekers, Ultra Garm, Ridgebacks, and War Garm by briefing and illustrations only, as their experience was limited to the spaceborne organisms. If the Einherjar died as often as they did, each of the men found himself thinking, what chance did a bunch of shunts have? "We can do this," Gunnar assured the men with what he hoped was a convincing tone, and then he opened the hatch. The armsman that was guarding their door was gone, and now that they were in the corridor, they could hear the sounds of battle on both sides of them. Alien screams echoed off the walls and were answered by shotgun blasts. Gunnar held his weapon at the ready and began moving down the corridor on his left away from Battery 13, where he was positive the monsters had either killed or driven off most of the defenders. From the ship layout in his memory, he was fairly certain that if they could hit the T-junction ahead, they could pop a hatch and climb up the two decks it would take to make it to the inter-ring causeway. He felt some guilt about abandoning the battery deck, though Gunnar reminded himself that even if men still fought, this ring was lost. An instant before Gunnar turned the corner, the voice in the back of his head screamed at him, and he swept his weapon up, throwing his body to the left. A bioblade embedded itself in the wall where his head had been. The Ripper drone howled in frustration as it wrenched the blade away, raising it for another strike. The deck chief squeezed the trigger of his shotgun and blasted the creature to pieces with 3 point-blank shots. "Pop the hatch!" shouted Gunnar, scrambling to his feet and pointing his weapon down the length of the T-junction. Another Ripper drone ducked back into a corridor, and the cloud of buckshot he fired at it pinged off of the deck without consequence. One of the remaining crew members crossed the T-junction and opened a small panel. He typed in a command, and a small door slid open at the junction. Behind the door was a tiny room with only a ladder that led up and down. Without pausing to clear it, the two crew members, both panicked by their first sight of the Garm up close, did not bother checking the tunnel in either direction, entering the hatch and climbing up. "Wait!" shouted Mateo, sprinting across the T-junction, having seen something in the tunnel that Gunnar could not. Before Mateo could reach them, screams and wet tearing sounds came from inside the maintenance tunnel. Gunnar turned and rushed back just in time to see Mateo use his shotgun to obliterate the skull of a Ripper drone. As the beast died, it released the hold on the crew member it had just killed, and both corpses plummeted down into the tunnel. Mateo fired several more rounds, and his shots were answered with bestial howls of pain, but no more bodies fell. "Back up and close the hatch," said Gunnar as he returned to the T-junction and swept his weapon around to cover all 3 angles of approach. "We'll have to find another way. Garm own the tunnels."
"If we move quickly, maybe we can hit one of the cargo elevators," suggested Zeke suddenly. "We can take that to the transit chamber and then it's a straight shot to the causeway."
"If they're already in the tunnels, why wouldn't they have the elevators too?" asked Mathis, the remaining target finder.
"They're giant space bugs, you shunt," snickered Mateo, after slamming shut the maintenance hatch.
"They'll find ways to move through the fortress the way a bug would, climbing on things, burrowing and the like. They won't move the way men do."
"He's right. We take the elevator. If they are in the shaft, then the box will crush them anyway," nodded Gunnar, as he started moving down the corridor.
"Just have to keep an eye on the emergency hatch."
The 3 men moved carefully down the labyrinth of corridors, and Gunnar was suddenly rather thankful for the monotonous existence of a gun servant aboard the Bifrost. He'd walked these corridors so much that he knew them so well he could probably navigate them blind, and it was like that for the other men as well. The Garm would not know what corridor led where, and if Mateo was right, which Gunnar was sure he was, the beasts would not think to activate a cargo elevator, if they could even distinguish its sliding doors and depressed control panel from a regular hatch anyway. Gunnar was certain that they were moving away from the fighting as the sounds of battle grew more distant, though he and Mateo both kept themselves at the ready. They reached the elevator, and Zeke entered his access code and desired destination. In a few seconds, the light went green, and the doors opened. Both men had their shotguns up when they realized that the elevator was occupied, though moved their weapons away when they realized who waited inside. Idris, one of the more famous body forge specialists in the Allfather's army, mostly because of his work with Hydra Company and Marine Ajax, stood inside the elevator. He too carried a shotgun, which he lowered onto the top of the resurrection pod that rested next to him.
"Enter and be quick about it, gentlemen," said Idris in a voice that assumed authority. As the 3 gun servants obeyed immediately, he added, "The causeway will not be kept accessible much longer."
"Sir, the body forge is on the inner ring. Why are you all the way out here?"
asked Zeke, despite Gunnar's look of admonishment about questioning a superior without provocation.
"The forge is gone. A spine frigate managed to get a firing solution and speared us before one of the remaining close-quarters batteries could eliminate it," sighed Idris, as he absently ran a hand across the plexiglass face of the pod, drawing Gunnar's eyes to the body that lay within.
"I managed to save this man alone, and he must survive, so I am taking the long way to the Watchman's Temple."
At first, the idea of a non-command individual, even one so esteemed a body forge specialist, deciding that they would board the Watchman's Temple ship was ludicrous.
Gunnar suddenly looked past the face that was masked with a rebreather and saw the name Ajax stenciled across the body glove mesh covering the man's chest. Gunnar's face snapped up to Idris, and the man returned the deck chief's look of shock with a weary smile.
"That is indeed who you think it is, deck chief," said Idris as the elevator continued to move. "Though he still sleeps, I have not yet divined a manner in which to resurrect him, though in light of recent events aboard this star fortress, I must make one last attempt. Assuming, of course, that I am able to get him aboard the temple before the watchman abandons ship."
"He is leaving us?" asked Mateo.
"Insurrections have sprung up across the UHC.
Reports of Garm organisms behind the front started making their way to command even as this battle fleet launched its attack on us here," Idris said as he shook his head.
"The Bifrost will fall today. Some parts of it will hold out for many hours, perhaps even days, but this fortress is broken as a military power in the universe. The Watchman will have recognized this truth, and no doubt shall make his escape. The war appears to have sprung up everywhere, and he is needed to re-establish some kind of coherent response."
Zeke opened his mouth to ask another question when something heavy landed on top of the elevator. In the blink of an eye, the emergency panel buckled and a ripper drone tore its way into the already cramped space. Mateo reacted swiftly and shoved the muzzle of his shotgun against the beast's thorax and fired. The blast of his weapon decapitated the beast and sent its corpse thrashing to the ground. Neither Gunnar nor any of his remaining crew had ever fought the Garm in a dirtside battle and had no experience with how deadly even a dying Garm could be. They soon found out. As the body of the drone continued flailing its limbs in all directions, and one of the scything bioblades sheared off Mateo's leg just above the knee. The man dropped his shotgun and went down as Gunnar screamed and pulped the alien corpse with several clusters of buckshot. Another drone slammed down onto the elevator just as the light flashed green, indicating that they'd reached the transit hub. Idris swiftly brought his shotgun up and fired it at the Ripper, blowing the drone off its feet and back away from the torn emergency hatch. The elevator doors opened and the men poured out of it as fast as they could. Zeke helped Idris pull the resurrection pod out of the elevator, and just as they got it clear, the wounded drone dropped through the panel. Gunnar blew a significant chunk of its upper torso into pieces. The beast was thrashing amidst the gory remains of its broodmate as the doors shut tightly. When Gunnar turned around, he saw that Mateo lay still, his eyes wide open, and from the massive pool of blood that led from the elevator to where his body now lay, it was clear he'd bled out from a severed artery.
"Chief, help us if you would, please," said Idris, capturing Gunnar's attention so that he could join the Forge Specialist and Zeke as they worked to lift the resurrection pod up and over a makeshift barricade that blocked the exit to the hub. Gunnar saw that there were two armsmen on the other side of the barrier, talking with Idris. Gunnar paused to snatch up Mateo's fallen shotgun, then joined them on the other side.
"The causeway doors are shorted out," one of the armsmen was telling Idris.
"Took a hit from the outside, not sure if the Garm did it on purpose or by accident.
We saw a Prax gunship just before everything went to hell," offered Zeke.
"Could be they hit all the causeways with rockets. That would certainly give the boarding parties a significantly better chance at seizing the whole fortress."
"Traitors have wounded us before," said Idris, speaking over the disbelief of the armsman.
"It is what it is. We'll never outrun the enemy. But we have to try."
Idris looked defeated, but he was resolved to press on, and Gunnar watched as the specialist set his shotgun on top of the pod and pushed it down the long causeway. Gunnar turned to Zeke, who stood with the other two armsmen, all watching Idris wrestle the pod across the causeway.
"You all saw who was in that pod, right?" asked Gunnar,
and slowly all three of the men nodded.
"He has to make it,"
breathed Zeke, shaking his head in disbelief.
"If anyone does, it has to be him."
"You're a believer in all that hero's journey garbage?" asked one of the armsmen.
"That Marine Ajax is something other than just another rifle-toting ground pounder?"
"The narrative strategy," corrected the other armsman. "And yes, I do."
"It's always seemed crazy to me, but it makes sense at the same time," agreed Zeke. "I don't know what that says about my sanity. Gunnar?"
"The alternative is too depressing," said Gunnar, his words accented by the sound of Ripper drones howling in the corridors beyond the barricade, with yet more bashing against the doors of the elevator.
two species spending eternity feeding on each other. I'd rather it be more than that.
You men coming or not? Called Idris from the other side of the causeway.
Gunnar looked from the forge specialist to the men around him, getting a nod from each, though some more reluctantly than others, and he realized what had to be done.
Go along without us, sir, said Gunnar with a raised voice as he gestured towards himself and the others. Third shift is still on the clock.
Idris bowed his head, and then disappeared into the inner ring with the resurrection pod in tow. Minutes later, Ripper drones swarmed out of the corridors and effortlessly poured over the makeshift barricade, all the effort expended in building it only buying the defenders a few seconds at best. Gunnar knew, flexing his grip on the shotgun, that each moment they delayed the enemy, Idris and Ajax, were another few steps closer to escape. The armsmen had shared their ammunition, so each man stood with a full cylinder at the ready.
Wait till they hit the threat line, ordered Gunnar as he raised his shotgun, keeping his eyes on the strip of tape that marked their range.
As the first of the drones crossed the tape, Zeke and the formerly reluctant armsmen unleashed a hurricane of buckshot down the causeway. They fired at the deck in front of the monster's feet, as they had been trained to do, in order to maximize the deadly ricochet factor of their shots. The Ripper Swarm's momentum did not slow, in spite of the horrendous damage being done to their bodies by the clouds of tiny projectiles. In the tightly packed causeway, the Ripper drones just tore through the bodies of the wounded and dying in their efforts to reach the human defenders. The sight of it made Gunnar's blood run cold, and in that moment, he almost fled. It was one thing to blast apart single Garm organisms during his shift's flight through the corridors, but facing off against a swarm of them sorely tested his resolve. That the Einherjar could just stand and fight against such horror over and over again was astounding. The sudden thought of their relentless courage put strength back in his limbs, and fury rushing into his soul. The swarm, now a roiling jumble of claws and teeth, pressed closer to them, gaining ground as the weapons of the first two shooters went dry. 60 rounds pumped into the enemy in the span of 2 breaths. As planned, Gunnar and the other armsmen stepped forward, the muzzles of their weapons only 2 meters away from the enemy. When Gunnar squeezed the trigger, he began to scream with a mixture of terror and elation as his close-quarters blast turned a Ripper drone into so much shredded meat. He continued to fire, squeezing the trigger and holding fast against the violent recoil of the weapon, his voice going ragged as he attacked the enemy. The voice in the back of his mind was screaming with him as if it too understood that this was it, and no amount of caution and cunning would see him through. Gunnar knew that somewhere behind him the others were frantically attempting to reload in time, but his concern was lost in the reverberating boom of his weapon and the snarling cacophony of the alien enemy. All his years and all his troubles, his victories and his defeats, distilled into these precious few moments. Bad deals and loved ones lost, failed resurrections and ceaseless toil, all to place him here, between the swarm and a legendary warrior the enemy just couldn't manage to kill. All the great stories were filled with men like Gunnar, nameless men that destiny had passed over in favor of others bound for glory. That had been a bitter pill to swallow when he'd emerged from the forge, a shunt and a reject. Next to him, the armsman spewed blood from his mouth as a Ripper bisected him at the waist with a swipe from its bioblade. The deck chief responded by splattering the beast across the opposite wall of the causeway. There was no torque around his neck, and he had but one life to give.
Live and die today, spat Gunnar,
as he charged the distracted Ripper drone and slammed his bare fist into the face of the Garm creature. An instant later, the deck chief disappeared under an avalanche of teeth and claws. Eight. Steel and Fire. The cascading snow fell in sheets, covering the debris-littered streets in a layer of white that sparkled with light from the fires that still burned in some of the nearby urban structures. Without a star in the sky, there was little to illuminate the endless night but those fires,
A sickening reminder that even now it was thanks to the rage of the enemy that the Allfather's warriors had light by which to do battle. Things moved in the smoky darkness above, their individual shapes difficult to distinguish from the billowing smoke that rose from the besieged city. What had once been a megacity, the name of which Marine Ajax could not recall, was now a smoldering ruin, and the field upon which warriors now fought monsters. He stood upon a modern street in the armor of an ancient people, his pulse rifle long discarded in favor of sword, axe, and spear. Ajax embraced the madness of it, having learned long ago in his fight with Grendel that the details of perception were fluid. He was a castaway of time and space, and to keep from drowning, he accepted the table set before him. Two ravens shrieked as they flew low over the heads of the assembled warriors, and everyone present knew that the dying was soon to begin. The blaring baritone note of a horn echoed through the maze of concrete and twisted metal, and Ajax flexed his fingers around the haft of his spear. Though his armored gloves were lined with fur meant to keep his body heat in, the biting cold made his joints ache through the layers. All around him, warriors fidgeted with their weapons, and their breath grew faster. The horn sounded again. A warrior rounded the corner of a blasted-out skyscraper. He was dressed much like Ajax and the men around him, with pieces of reinforced steel across his chest and shoulders, articulated gauntlets over his hands, and the rest of him covered in layers of chainmail and boiled leather. The helmet that protected his skull was dented and the man's face awash in blood. Upon seeing Ajax and the 24 warriors filling the street, the wounded man raised the horn to his lips and blew upon it once more. The single note thundered over the pavement, filling the block with its defiant sound. As the note died away, the horn slipped from his fingers, and the warrior stumbled, then fell face first into the street, his fall revealing 4 arrows embedded deep in his back. "Shield wall!" bellowed the Jarl, who stood just steps behind Ajax, and the warriors raised their shields of wood and steel, interlocking them to create protection for themselves and their comrades. Ajax set his shield on the edge of the one in front of him, then hefted his spear with a reverse grip. Howls filled the night air, drowning out even the roar of the wind and the crackle of the many fires. The warriors stood holding their formation, and they waited. More howls called out, yet more unanswered, and soon the rumble of many hooves joined the scraping of many claws. They were coming, and there was naught to do but meet them. Ajax was weary, his arms already feeling like they'd been turned to lead. It felt as though he and his surviving brothers had been fighting ceaselessly. He found that he could not recall the look of the sun upon the city, nor the warmth of anything but hot blood splattering across him in the thick of combat. When night had fallen, he could not dredge up many details about the battle from his memory. He knew the fight about to come was just the next in a long campaign of violence. He could not possibly assign a number to it. "Battles beyond counting," he growled to himself. "Yet still they come, and still we stand." The enemy seemed to materialize out of the darkness, the sickening shapes of them becoming visible as they emerged from shadows, crawled out of broken windows, rushed from battered down doors, and charged out of alleys and street corners. They were not men, though plenty of them ran on 2 feet and appeared to carry swords of a kind. They were not wolves, though their mouths were filled with fangs and their fingers tipped with claws. They were not giants, though they towered over the men who faced them. They were not gods either, for when the first of the warrior's spears were hurled, the points bit deep and blood flowed as some throws were struck well. Ajax howled with a voice raw from the cold as his own spear pierced the torso of a hideous creature and sent the thing sprawling and bleeding into the snow. The monsters leaped over their dead and dying with sickening grace, their bladed appendages outstretched and their fanged maws leering with anticipation of the kills to come. "Give them the death they so crave," shouted the Jarl, and Ajax slid his short axe from the iron ring hanging at his waist. A moment later, the first of the beasts slammed into the shield wall, lashing out with their claws and blades, using their muscular bodies to push against the shields in an attempt to break through. Ajax strained to hold firm as the weight of a creature pounded against his shield,
the force of the impact sending reverberations down his arm and into his feet. The potency of their charge was tremendous, and the entire formation of human warriors was pushed back by inches, their boots scraping against the pavement and kicking up snow behind them. Despite the ferocity of the assault, the line held firm, and the momentum of the charging beasts stalled. As one, the warriors pressed forward, slamming their shields into the creatures who were now caught off balance. Several of the enemy fell as they were knocked off their feet by the sudden opposition, though most were able to regain their footing in an instant. However, an instant was all that the warriors needed. Suddenly, axes rained down heavy blows from above, splitting skulls and crushing bones, while thrusts from swords pierced abdomens and savaged legs. Ajax pulled hard and yanked his axe from the spurting wound he'd made in the neck of one creature, only to bring it down again a mere second later to shear away a piece of another's hideous skull. The warrior stepped forward and bashed his shield into the beast he'd hit in the neck and hissed in satisfaction as it fell backward to lay still. A bladed appendage suddenly raked against his side, and Ajax felt the edge part his chainmail and leather armor like a knife through cloth. He managed to deflect the next attack with his shield, turning aside the appendage and cleaving the limb from its master with a swift chop from his axe into what passed for an elbow. The beast screamed in pain and raised more of its limbs to attack him. The action was cut short as another warrior skewered it with his sword, driving his blade underneath the beast's natural chest armor and up through a few of its hearts. As the warrior pulled his sword free, his arm and head were simultaneously separated from his body by the powerful strokes of another creature's scything blades. Ajax's vision was obscured for a moment as his comrade's blood spattered across his helmet, some of it getting through the eye slits and blinding him. The moment that blood hit his pupils, Ajax's mind was filled with the sound of children calling out for him.
Why in the name of the Allfather would children be in this place?
Yet they called his name, their voices brittle and insistent. Ajax shook his head as he struggled to keep their voices from overwhelming his senses at such a deadly moment. Ajax covered himself with his shield as he stumbled to the side, and in doing so narrowly avoided death from the strike of multiple blades filling the space where he'd just stood. A blade bit into his thigh, and clawed hands attempted to rip the shield off his arm, the strength of the beast forcing him to his knees. Ajax swung his axe blindly and shouted with victory as he felt the weapon connect with enemy flesh, though the blade was pulled from his hand as the monster reacted. The beast collapsed on top of his shield, its weight pressing down on him until he was able to heave it off to the side. Free of the corpse's weight, Ajax was able to get back on his feet, pushing through the pain in his thigh. The creature fell hard onto the snow-covered pavement, and before it could rise, Ajax brought the edge of his shield down onto its chest. All the while, he could hear the children screaming for rescue. The warrior put all his weight behind his shield for the next strike and the next, blindly working his way up the creature's body as he continued to pound it with his shield. He knew that his strikes would do little but keep it pinned down until he eventually found its head. When he did, several strikes later, it took 3 tries to crush the beast's skull. Ajax risked removing his helmet and wiping his bloody eyes. Doing so did nothing to quiet the voices in his ears, though having his sight back was at least something. When his vision cleared, he saw that the fighting had escalated significantly. The shield wall was broken, and the battle had devolved into a wild melee. His own group of warriors looked to have lost at least half their number, though they had done as much, if not worse, to the enemy. More warriors of the Allfather had marched into the streets and were engaging yet more swarms of the nightmare creatures. The children called out again, and Ajax felt as if he'd heard them with his ears as much as his mind this time. It sounded to him that they were just beyond the battle, through the ruins of a skyscraper across the street. He was compelled to move towards them, and he could not tell if it was some draw against him that was outside himself, or his own will to reach them. Regardless, he knew he had to go.
"On me!" shouted Ajax as he slid his helmet back over his head and recovered his gore-caked axe from the leg of the beast he'd just slain.
The warrior rushed forward, shield held before him, and after a few hurried steps he was joined by four other warriors who'd heard his voice over the din of violence. Ajax knocked aside a creature that stood in his way, slamming the edge of his shield into the small of its back, producing a satisfying wet crack. He kept running, not taking time to kill the creature, instead taking several more strides and sinking his axe into the shoulder of another. One of the warriors next to him stabbed the beast in the abdomen with his sword and then bowled it over with his shield as he continued to follow Ajax. Moments later, Ajax and the three warriors reached the smoldering ruins of the skyscraper. One of their number lay dying in the street behind them, his innards spilled across the pavement as two creatures feasted upon him, tearing apart his layers of armor to get at his flesh. They had no time to seek revenge, that much Ajax knew as the voices of the children became more insistent. Ajax nodded at the men with him and they entered the ruined building, leaving the storm of battle behind them and plunging into the half-light of the structure. The skyscraper was being held aloft by the thick pylons that supported the superstructure, though the entire ground floor had been torn to shreds. Whether it was from artillery shell or the thrashing of a giant, perhaps lightning strikes or earthquakes, Ajax could not recall. Such memories seemed lost to him as it was to the others. One of the warriors tapped flint to steel and the sparks ignited a torch, which he used to light those carried by the rest of the men. The light of their torches threw shadows around them, the ragged interior of the building causing many tricks in the light. The warriors looked expectantly at him, and Ajax closed his eyes, narrowing his focus to the sounds of the children, and he was able to hear them. Their voices were muffled now, and it felt to him that their pleas were carrying up from under his feet. Ajax swung his torch about and saw an ash-covered metro sign. As he stalked closer, he saw that it pointed to a stairwell leading downwards. Ajax knew better than to think that the elevator would work, so kicked open the stairwell door with a booted foot and thrust his torch into the darkness. When no enemy presented itself, he nodded to the other warriors, and they all began to make their way down the stairs. As they went down the first flight, they began to hear the enemy above them, howls and snarls of the enemy that no doubt had picked up their scent. None could escape the battle that would never be ended, Ajax found himself thinking, and he locked eyes with the warrior nearest him. Ajax and the warrior held each other's gaze for a moment. Then the warrior turned to face the stairs above them. He moved back up several steps, and then stood on the platform just under the door they'd entered through. In the tight confines, his sword would be more useful than the axes carried by Ajax and the others. He would be able to buy them sometime, not much, but perhaps enough. Ajax turned, and he began to take the stairs downwards two at a time. By the time they reached the bottom of the stairwell, they'd gone down what Ajax thought to have been at least five flights. They had not bothered to open any of the doors to the other subterranean floors. Down this far, everything would be maintenance levels and storage. Ajax was sure the voices were coming from the bottommost level, down where the metro tunnels were built, forming the underground circulatory system of the once glittering megacity. When the warriors opened the door and rushed onto the platform, with torch and axe in hand, their eyes were greeted with a curious sight. In place of the metro tunnel they'd expected, there was a vast black ocean before them, the dark waters churning in the half-light of their torches and seeming to go on forever. In place of the familiar mag train were two boats, identical to the low-slung dragon ships of an ancient warrior culture, their wooden masts carved with an assortment of spirals and runes. On the platform rested a haphazard pile of supplies, everything from casks of whale oil and sacks of seed to farming tools and bolts of cloth. As the warriors looked upon the pile, trying to make sense of what they were seeing, an inhuman roar made their heads snap to the right. The heavy steel door of the platform's maintenance closet was set into the concrete wall, and it was covered in the dense and deep claw rents of the nightmare creature that raged against it. The beast was just as foul as any they'd faced on the streets above, and as it turned, finally noticing the warriors, Ajax realized that the children he heard were behind the door. He could hear them pleading for help through the steel, and this time the other two warriors with him heard it too.
The creature rushed the warriors, all four of its scything-bladed appendages outstretched. Ajax reacted swiftly and hurled his axe at the beast, raising his shield and stepping to his left. The creature was fast, and it batted the axe out of the air just as it came in range, though in doing so left it exposed to the axe from another warrior. The creature stumbled as the thrown axe thudded into the side of its head, opening a deep gash through the beast's natural armor before clattering to the platform floor. Another axe tore into the beast's right knee, the bladed head wedging into the small gap where the beast's natural thigh armor was overlapped by the plate that protected its knee. The monster howled in pain and fury, and the warriors surged forward as they yanked their daggers from the sheaths at their waists. The monster lashed out with its blades, only to have its blows turned away by the shields of the men as they used their defensive tools to push in unison against the creature. The three warriors shoved the creature back and against the platform wall, next to the door it had only moments before been assaulting. While the warriors held the beast pinned, they stabbed at it with their short daggers. In a matter of seconds, the creature was bleeding from half a dozen more wounds. Finally, all the strength left it, and the warriors stepped away to allow the corpse to fall in a heap before them. The warriors turned from their slain enemy and saw that two children had emerged from the maintenance closet. They were dressed in peasant's garb, simple layers of cloth and fur, with boots and gloves to protect them from the cold. They couldn't have been more than 10 or 12 years old from the looks of them, their breath misting heavily in the underground cold. Their faces were not familiar to him, though like the warriors who had fought and died beside him for what seemed an eternity, he felt as if he'd known them all his life. They were silent now, and they looked from Ajax and his warriors to the boats even as inhuman screams echoed out from the stairwell to join the dying roars of the warrior they'd left behind. One of the warriors responded by pulling his axe from the knee of the dead monster and setting his torch into a crack in the wall. He fastened his shield to his left arm and then picked his torch back up, holding it in his shield arm. He nodded to the two men and hefted his axe before walking to the door and disappearing up the stairwell. Ajax and the remaining warrior rushed to get the children into the boats and did not argue when it appeared that each child demanded their own ship. It made sense to Ajax as much as anything did, and he obliged them. The boy he placed in the leftmost ship as his comrade lifted the girl up and set her down on the bow of the rightmost ship. The two men then moved as quickly as they could, tossing cargo onto the boats as the sound of battle reverberated on the platform. They'd loaded the boats with about half of what rested on the platform when a hideous roar boomed in the stairwell, and it was clear that the enemy was upon them. The last warrior said nothing, only turned and lifted his shield as he swung his axe back and forth to limber up his killing hand. He reached the door just as it was torn from his hinges by the first of the creatures, and he rewarded the beast by hewing its head from its shoulder.